which would certainly require a disciplined force. By early 1799, Hamilton advocated the South American operation far more openly, telling Harrison Gray Otis, who chaired the House Committee on Defense, "If universal empire is still to be the pursuit of France, what can tend to defeat the purpose better than to detach South America from Spain, which is only the channel through which the riches of Mexico and Peru are conveyed to France? The executive ought to be put in a situation to embrace favorable conjunctures for effecting that separation." As it happened, the chief executive rightly thought the whole plan an unspeakable piece of folly that would tear the country apart. "I do not know whether to laugh or weep," Adams said of the intended scheme. "Miranda's project is as visionary, though far less innocent, than an excursion to the moon in a cart drawn by geese." Adams then extrapolated a legitimate concern into a full-fledged conspiracy theory, telling Elbridge Gerry that he thought Hamilton and a party were endeavoring to get an army on foot to give Hamilton the command of it, and then to proclaim a regal government, place Hamilton at the head of it, and prepare the way for a province of Great Britain. Adams later swore that he would have resigned before approving the Miranda Plan, which would have produced an instantaneous insurrection of the whole nation from Georgia to New Hampshire. Hamilton believed that the United States should preemptively seize Spanish Florida and Louisiana, lest they fall into hostile French hands. To accomplish this, he directed General James Wilkinson to assemble an armada of 75 riverboats. The son of a Maryland planter, the hard-drinking Wilkinson was always ready for any mayhem. It later turned out that he had pocketed stipends from the Spanish government to incite a transfer of the Kentucky Territory to Spain. John Randolph of Roanoke called Wilkinson the mammoth of iniquity, "the only man I ever saw who was from the bark to the very core a villain." The plump, ruddy Wilkinson made a showy appearance, wearing medals and gold buttons on his braided uniform. Even in the backwoods, he rode around in gold stirrups and spurs while seated on a leopard saddle cloth. He was happy to assist Hamilton in his expansionist plans. Wilkinson wanted to create a string of forts along the western edge of American settlement, measures that even Hamilton thought excessive. The imbecility of the Spanish government on the Mississippi is as manifest as the ardor of the French fanatics of Louisiana is obvious, Wilkinson told Hamilton. Hamilton never carried out his plans for Louisiana or Florida, much less for Spanish America. As the original rationale for his army, defense against a French invasion was increasingly undercut by peace negotiations, such plans seemed increasingly pointless, preposterous, and irrelevant. Still, the episode went down as one of the most flagrant episodes of poor judgment in Hamilton's career. Chapter 32. Reign of Witches. The period of John Adams's presidency declined into a time of political savagery with few parallels in American history, a season of paranoia in which the two parties surrendered all trust in each other. Like other Federalists infected with war fever, Hamilton increasingly mistook dissent for treason and engaged in hyperbole. In one newspaper piece, he blasted the Jeffersonians as more Frenchmen than Americans, and declared that to slake their ambition and thirst for revenge, they stood ready to immolate the independence and welfare of their country at the shrine of France. Republicans behaved no better, interpreting policies they disliked as the treacherous deeds of men in league with England and bent on bringing back George III. The indiscriminate use of pejorative labels, Jacobins for Republicans, Anglomen for Federalists, reflected the rancorously unfair emotions. During this melancholy time, the Founding Fathers appeared as all too fallible mortals. An episode at Congress Hall in January 1798 symbolized the acrimonious mood. Representative Matthew Lyon of Vermont, a diehard Republican, began to mock the aristocratic sympathies of Roger Griswold, a Federalist from Connecticut. When Griswold then taunted Lyon for alleged cowardice during the Revolution, Lyon spat right in his face. Griswold got a hickory cane and proceeded to thrash Lyon, who retaliated by taking up fire tongs and attacking Griswold. The two members of Congress ended up fighting on the floor like common ruffians. Party animosities have raised a wall of separation between those who differ in political sentiments, Jefferson wrote sadly to Angelica Church. The publication of the XYZ dispatches led to an even more militant atmosphere in Philadelphia. Violent clashes arose between roving bands of Federalists sporting black cockades and Republicans wearing French tricolor cockades. Actors singing the Marseillaise were booed off one stage. A Federalist gang descended upon the Republican newspaper, the Aurora, and not only smashed the windows of editor Benjamin Franklin Bache, but smeared a statue of his revered grandfather with mud. As rumors gathered that French saboteurs might torch the city, John Adams stationed guards outside the presidential residence and laid in a store of arms. The low point of his presidency came in June and July 1798. While Adams wrestled with Hamilton over the ranking of Washington's major generals, Congress enacted four infamous laws designed to muzzle dissent and browbeat the Republicans into submission. They were known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. The Neutralization Act, passed on June 18th, lengthened from 5 to 14 years the period necessary to become a naturalized citizen with full voting rights. The Alien Act of June 25th gave the president the power to deport, without a hearing or even a reasonable explanation, any foreign-born residents deemed dangerous to the peace. The Alien Enemies Act of July 6th granted the president the power to label as enemy aliens any residents who were citizens of a country at war with America, prompting an outflow of French émigrés. Then came the capstone of these horrendous measures, the Sedition Act of July 14th, which rendered it a crime to speak or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious writings against the U.S. government or Congress with intent to defame or to bring them into contempt or disrepute. If found guilty, the perpetrators could face up to $2,000 in fines and 2 years in prison. The Federalist-controlled Congress was maneuvering for partisan advantage and betraying an unbecoming nativist streak. Federalists wanted to curb an influx of Irish immigrants who were usually pro-French and thus natural adherents to the Republican cause. Congressman Harrison Gray Otis of Boston set a strident tone when he declared that America should no longer wish to invite hordes of wild Irishmen, nor the turbulent and disorderly parts of the world, to come here with a view to disturb our tranquility after having succeeded in the overthrow of their own governments. Another grievance rife among Federalists was reckless press behavior. During the 1790s, as the number of American newspapers more than doubled, many partisan sheets specialized in vituperative character attacks. Jefferson acknowledged the strategic power of these papers for Federalists and Republicans alike. "The engine is the press," he told Madison. "Every man must lay his purse and his pen under contribution." John Adams had learned to loathe many members of the Republican press. After Benjamin Franklin Bache died at 29 in September 1798 in a yellow fever epidemic, which also claimed the life of Federalist rival John Fenno, Adams described Bache as a malicious libeler and said the yellow fever arrested him in his detestable career and sent him to his grandfather, from whom he inherited a dirty, envious, jealous, and revengeful spite against me. Embittered by published screeds against her husband, Abigail Adams wrote perfervid letters in support of the Alien and Sedition Acts. Until Congress passed a sedition bill, she warned her sister-in-law, nothing would halt the wicked and base, violent and calumniating abuse of the Republican papers. She added that in any other country, Bache and all his papers would have been seized long ago. She hoped the Alien Act would be invoked to oust the Swiss-born Albert Gallatin, the House Republican leader after Madison's departure. She considered Gallatin and his Jeffersonian colleagues little more than traitors to their country. She also distrusted immigrants, averring that a more careful and attentive watch ought to be kept over foreigners. Of course, the supreme bugaboo of Republican scribes was Alexander Hamilton. On May 21, 1798, William Cateltus, a Republican lawyer in New York, chastised him for ingratitude to a nation that had embraced him as a young man. Cateltus likened him to Caesar. "But like Caesar, you are ambitious, and for that ambition to enslave his country, Brutus slew him. And are ambitious men less dangerous to American than Roman liberty?" Replying in the same newspaper the next day, Hamilton drew a dire inference about the author. By the allusion to Caesar and Brutus, he plainly hints at assassination. John Adams always tried to sidestep responsibility for the Alien and Sedition Acts, the biggest blunder of his presidency. He did not shepherd these punitive laws through Congress, but they were passed by a Federalist-dominated Congress during his tenure and with his tacit approval. After Hamilton was dead, Adams did not hesitate to blame him for these unfortunate measures. Upon taking office in 1797, Adams maintained, he had gotten a memo from Hamilton recommending an alien and sedition law. Embroidering this recollection in 1809, Adams thumped his chest proudly at his principled rejection of Hamilton's advice. "I recommended no such thing in my speech." Congress, however, adopted both these measures. "I knew there was need enough of both and therefore consented to them. But as they were then considered as war measures and intended altogether against the advocates of the French and peace with France, I was apprehensive that a hurricane of clamor might be raised against them." Adams straddled two positions here, presenting himself as both prescient critic and reluctant advocate of the Alien and Sedition Acts. The truth is that Hamilton never espoused any such laws in the memos he drew up after Adams's inauguration. So what did Hamilton think of the notorious laws? Fearing an American fifth column, he now wanted to throttle the flow of immigration. "My opinion is that the mass of aliens ought to be obliged to leave the country," a disappointing stance from America's most famous foreign-born citizen and once an influential voice for immigration. He did argue for exceptions, however, and admonished Pickering, "Let us not be cruel or violent." In contrast, he was stunned by his first glance at the Sedition Act, protesting to Treasury Secretary Wolcott, "There are provisions in this bill which, according to a cursory view, appear to me highly exceptionable, and such as more than anything else may endanger civil war. I hope sincerely the thing may not be hurried through. Let us not establish a tyranny. Energy is a very different thing from violence." Unfortunately, once they were amended, Hamilton supported the Alien and Sedition Acts. Among other things, he was still outraged by the cutthroat behavior of the Scottish-born James T. Callender, who had exposed the Reynolds scandal. By late 1799, Hamilton exhorted Senator Jonathan Dayton to prosecute such foreign-born journalists, claiming that in open contempt and defiance of the laws, they are permitted to continue their destructive labors. "Why are they not sent away? Are laws of this kind passed merely to excite odium and remain a dead letter?" Hamilton was never an automatic press critic, however much he deplored its abuses. And he justly applauded one meritorious idea buried in the Sedition Act, that in libel cases, the truth of an allegation should be allowed as a defense. Before, it had been necessary for the prosecution to prove only that the charges were defamatory, not that they were true. Hamilton would have much more to say about this issue in a dramatic legal case that was to expand press freedom in the United States. For this reason, he later said that the sedition law, branded indeed with epithets the most odious, will one day be pronounced a valuable feature in our national character. For Republicans, however, the most salient feature of the Sedition Act was that it violated the First Amendment of the Constitution. Republicans knew the unashamedly partisan nature of the new bills. "The alien bill proposed in the Senate is a monster that must forever disgrace its parents," Madison told Jefferson, who quickly agreed that it was a most detestable thing. So he would not have to preside over a Senate enacting legislation that he found hateful, Jefferson slipped away from Philadelphia and took refuge at Monticello for 4.5 months. Beyond indignation, Jefferson professed a serene faith that the common sense of the people would rectify such errors. He told a fellow Virginian, "A little patience, and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolved, and the people, recovering their true sight, restoring their government to its true principles." He would not rely upon patience alone. He believed that Washington had checked the most harmful tendencies of the Federalists, but that under Adams the party had mounted on the car of state, and free from control, like Phaethon on that of the sun, drove headlong and wild. Often amazingly accurate in his predictions, Jefferson saw the country approaching a political crossroads. The Federalists were displaying insufferable arrogance and using federal power to snuff out the opposition. In so doing, he concluded, they would relinquish the advantages they had won through the XYZ dispatches. Perhaps suffering from fatigue after almost a decade in power, the Federalists were governed more by fear than by hope. They had helped to build a durable government, but did not trust the strength of the institutions they had so well created. Ironically, it was Jefferson, searing in his criticism of Federalist measures, who surveyed the future with habitual optimism. The Alien and Sedition Acts unified the Republican Party, while unchecked warfare between the Adams and Hamilton wings of the Federalist Party was inwardly eroding its strength. Many Republicans thought it best to sit back and let the Federalists blow themselves up. As James Monroe put it, the more the Federalist Party was left to itself, the sooner will its ruin follow. Jefferson and Madison were not that patient, especially after Hamilton became Inspector General of the new army. Jefferson thought the Republicans had a duty to stop the Sedition Act, explaining later that he considered that law to be a nullity as absolute and as palpable as if Congress had ordered us to fall down and worship a golden image. With Federalists in control of the government, this political magician decided that he and Madison would draft resolutions for two state legislatures, declaring the Alien and Sedition Acts to be unconstitutional. The two men operated by stealth and kept their authorship anonymous to create the illusion of a groundswell of popular opposition. Jefferson drafted his resolution for the Kentucky legislature and Madison for Virginia. The Kentucky resolutions passed on November 16, 1798, and the Virginia resolutions on December 24. Jefferson's biographer Dumas Malone has noted that the vice president could have been brought up on sedition charges, possibly even impeached for treason, had his actions been uncovered at the time. In writing the Kentucky resolutions, Jefferson turned to language that even Madison found excessive. Of the Alien and Sedition Acts, he warned that unless arrested at the threshold, they would necessarily drive these states into revolution and blood. He wasn't calling for peaceful protests or civil disobedience. He was calling for outright rebellion, if needed, against the federal government of which he was vice president. In editing Jefferson's words, the Kentucky legislature deleted his call for nullification of laws that violated states' rights. The more moderate Madison said that the states, in contesting obnoxious laws, should interpose for arresting the progress of the evil. This was a breathtaking evolution for a man who had pleaded at the Constitutional Convention that the federal government should possess a veto over state laws. In the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, Jefferson and Madison set forth a radical doctrine of states' rights that effectively undermined the Constitution. Neither Jefferson nor Madison sensed that they had sponsored measures as inimical as the Alien and Sedition Acts themselves. Their nullification effort, if others had picked it up, would have been a greater threat to freedom than the misguided Alien and Sedition laws, which were soon rendered feckless by ridicule and electoral pressure, Gary Wills has written. The theoretical damage of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions was deep and lasting. Hamilton and others had argued that the Constitution transcended state governments and directly expressed the will of the American people. Hence, the Constitution began, "We the people of the United States," and was ratified by special conventions, not state legislatures. Now, Jefferson and Madison lent their imprimatur to an outmoded theory in which the Constitution became a compact of the states, not of their citizens. By this logic, states could refrain from complying with federal legislation they considered unconstitutional. This was a clear recipe for calamitous dissension and ultimate disunion. George Washington was so appalled by the Virginia resolutions that he told Patrick Henry that if systematically and pertinaciously pursued, they would dissolve the Union or produce coercion. The influence of the doctrine of states' rights, especially in the version promulgated by Jefferson, reverberated right up to the Civil War and beyond. At the close of that war, James Garfield of Ohio, the future president, wrote that the Kentucky resolutions contained the germ of nullification and secession, and we are today reaping the fruits. For Hamilton, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions threatened to undo his lifelong goal of molding the states into a single, indivisible nation. Rejecting as a gangrene the idea that states could arbitrarily disobey certain federal laws, he asserted categorically that this would change the government. He inquired of Theodore Sedgwick, a high Federalist, "What, my dear sir, are you going to do with Virginia? This is a very serious business, which will call for the wisdom and firmness of the government." Hamilton wanted the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions submitted to a special congressional committee, which would expose how they would destroy the Constitution and afford evidence of a regular conspiracy to overturn the government, Just as Jefferson believed that Republicans could turn the Alien and Sedition Acts to advantage, so Hamilton thought the Federalists could capitalize on the misconceived Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. "If well managed," he told Rufus King, "this affair will turn to good account." Of the quartet of laws intended to silence dissent, the Sedition Act proved the most pernicious. Indictments were brought against Republican editors based on flimsy, trumped-up charges. Some people were hauled into court for the heinous crime of setting up a liberty pole with the banner, "No Stamp Act, No Sedition, No Alien Bill, No Land Tax, Downfall to the Tyrants of America, Peace and Retirement to the President." One Republican editor made the mistake of calling Hamilton's projected army a standing army and paid a steep price, a $200 fine plus 2 months in prison, where he could ponder his linguistic error. Another editor earned 18 months behind bars for daring to print the heresy that the government allowed the wealthy to benefit at the expense of commoners. Congressman Matthew Lyon of Vermont got 4 months in jail for criticizing the president's unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and selfish avarice. The most outlandish case involved the prosecution of Luther Baldwin of New Jersey, who, under the spell of strong drink, wished that the ceremonial cannon fire greeting President Adams had landed in his backside. 5 of the 6 most influential Republican papers were ultimately prosecuted under the new laws by a Federalist-dominated judiciary. During the reign of the Alien and Sedition Acts, Hamilton, long embattled by slander, instigated a libel suit against New York's leading Republican newspaper, the Argus. After the death of publisher Thomas Greenleaf in September 1798, his widow Anne perpetuated the paper's crusade against the Adams administration. Backed by the Sedition Act, Secretary of State Pickering, nicknamed the Scourge of Jacobinism for exploiting the government's new prosecutorial powers, asked New York District Attorney Richard Harrison to monitor the Argus for audacious calumnies against the government. This led to a sedition prosecution against Anne Greenleaf for her paper's contention that the federal government was corrupt and inimical to the preservation of liberty. Her problems were exacerbated on November 6, 1799, when the paper reprinted an article alleging that Hamilton had tried to squash the Philadelphia-based Aurora by offering to buy it for $6,000 from the widow of Benjamin Franklin Bache. The sum was supposedly Hamilton's share of a joint Federalist bid. Margaret Bache claimed that she had rebuffed Hamilton's offer in high dudgeon, insisting that she would never dishonor her husband's memory by selling to Federalists. Aside from the small detail that he had never made such a bid, what irked Hamilton was that the Aurora had spun a tangled skein of speculation as to where he might have gotten the $6,000. How, the Aurora queried, could Hamilton afford this when he had made so much of his inability to pay James Reynolds, the reputed husband of the dear Maria, $1,000? The Aurora author served up a ready-made answer. The funds came from British Secret Service money. One would have supposed Mr. Hamilton might have fallen upon a better plan to suppress the Aurora, for it is a bungling piece of work at best. For years, Hamilton had tried ceaselessly to stamp out slander and preserve his reputation. Now he was convinced that it was all part of a well-organized plot to overthrow the government, as evidenced by the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. The same day that the Argus ran its offending piece about him, he composed an angry letter to Josiah Ogden Hoffman, New York's Attorney General, asking for criminal prosecution of the perpetrators on libel charges. He cast his grievance in cosmic terms, saying that he had long been subject to the most malignant calumnies, but had refrained from libel suits, repaying hatred with contempt. He continued, "But public motives now compel me to a different conduct. The designs of that faction to overturn our government become every day more manifest and have of late acquired a degree of system which renders them formidable. One principal engine for effecting the scheme is by audacious falsehoods to destroy the confidence of the people in all those who are in any degree conspicuous among the supporters of the government." The next day, Cadwallader Colden, the Assistant Attorney General, visited Anne Greenleaf to apprise her of the prosecution. When she pleaded that she had merely reprinted the questionable article from another paper, Colden pointed out that under the Sedition Act, her paper was still liable. Greenleaf then tried another line of defense. She had played no part in running the paper. The suit was therefore filed against the editor, David Frothingham, who tried to dodge prosecution by billing himself as a journeyman printer in the Argus office. Despite his demanding duties as Inspector General, Hamilton sat in on the trial, itching to testify. According to one newspaper account, the Attorney General told the court that Hamilton's reputation depended in a great measure on the verdict then to be given. This was dearer to the witness than property or life. In retrospect, this statement has an eerily true ring. Falling back on the common law, the court did not allow Hamilton to testify as to the truth or falsity of the charges leveled against him, a situation that may have firmed his resolve to establish this principle in American libel law. He did testify to general circumstances about the articles and said he had never made any offer for the Aurora. Asked whether the Aurora was hostile to the U.S. government, Hamilton fired back a resounding yes. Frothingham was convicted, fined $100, and incarcerated in Bridewell Prison for 4 months. For the Republican press, the Frothingham conviction had one inestimable virtue. It allowed a full-scale reprise of the Mariah Reynolds affair, a subject of which readers never tired. With heavy sarcasm, Hamilton was now styled the amorous general. Both the Argus and the Aurora cast him as a heartless scamp who had gone from a dalliance with Mariah Reynolds, under the guise of protecting her, to the callous prosecution of the widow Bache. The Aurora taunted this distinguished man of gallantry and added that the heart of this man must be formed of peculiar stuff. Another Republican paper suggested that Hamilton's pursuit of the Argus had been revenge for the Reynolds exposé, saying of Hamilton that it is very likely his ire has been provoked against the press for publishing to the world what a good friend he has been to female distress, how like the angel of charity he has poured the balm of consolation on the wounds of a poverty-struck matron, that he deigned to stoop from his then high and important station to console the sorrows and to relieve the woes of an afflicted fair one. If Hamilton's aim had been to crush the Argus, he succeeded. The following year, Anne Greenleaf shut down the paper and sold its equipment, depriving the Republicans of a key party organ on the eve of national elections. Hamilton's tough action against the Argus involved a legitimate case of libel. Far more questionable was the use he wished to make of the new army to deal with domestic disturbances. All along, Republicans had worried that his soldiers would pounce on them instead of Napoleon. The Aurora, as usual, sounded the alert. The echoes of our ministerial oracles assert that the army of mercenaries contemplated to be raised are entirely for home service. In some respects, the threat from Hamilton was exaggerated. His army remained more hypothetical than real, and he never commanded a large force. He would also have required the approval of President Adams for any domestic use of force. But the record shows that the Inspector General did have domestic as well as foreign enemies on his mind, especially after passage of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. In a letter he sent to Harrison Gray Otis on December 27, 1798, he argued against any force reduction by noting that with a view to the possibility of internal disorders alone, the force authorized is not too considerable. From William Heth, a Federalist customs collector in Virginia, he received disturbing reports of a possible armed insurrection against the federal government. "You ask, what does the Republican faction in your state aim at?" Heth reported. "I answer, nothing short of disunion and the heads of John Adams and Alexander Hamilton and some few others, perhaps." Heth misled Hamilton with an erroneous report that the Virginia legislature had decided to buy arms to combat the federal government. By this point, Hamilton thought it might be necessary to put down subversion in Virginia, and this became integral to his rationale for a national army instead of state militias. "Whenever the experiment shall be made to subdue a refractory and powerful state by militia," he told Theodore Sedgwick, "the event will shame the advocates. When a clever force has been collected, let them be drawn towards Virginia, for which there is an obvious pretext. And then let measures be taken to act upon the laws and put Virginia to the test of resistance." Jefferson watched Hamilton warily, telling one ally that our Bonaparte might step in to give us political salvation in his own way. The violent resistance to federal law foreseen by Hamilton cropped up in eastern Pennsylvania instead of Virginia. The opposition was centered in three counties north of Philadelphia. Bucks, Northampton, and Montgomery, with dense concentrations of German immigrants. They were generally uneducated and easily misled by rumors, such as the notion that President Adams planned a wedding between one of his sons and a daughter of George III. Local residents were so upset by federal property taxes, imposed to finance the quasi-war with France, that they resisted new property assessments. The ringleader of this obstruction was a cooper, auctioneer, and former militia captain named John Freeze, who had 10 children. After marshals arrested a group of tax protesters, Freeze stormed the Bethlehem jail along with 150 armed militiamen to free the prisoners. President Adams decided to send in troops to squash the rebellion, and on March 12, 1799, issued a proclamation ordering the army to put down combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. Having declared this emergency, Adams left Philadelphia the same day for Quincy, Massachusetts. Since Hamilton was the de facto commander of the army, he had to handle the disorder, which became known as Freeze's Rebellion. He was handicapped by the lack of presidential leadership. "I get nothing very precise about the insurrection," he complained to Washington. "But everything continues to wear the character of feebleness in respect to the measures for suppressing it." Treasury Secretary Wolcott, despondent over the president's improbable absence in the midst of a crisis, wrote to Hamilton from Philadelphia, "I am grieved when I think of the situation of the government. An affair which ought to have been settled at once will cost much time and perhaps be so managed as to encourage other and formidable rebellions. We have no president here, and the appearance of languor and indecision are discouraging to the friends of government." To deal with the rebellion, Hamilton assembled a force that blended state militia and federal regulars. Believing, as always, that psychology was half the battle, Hamilton decided to stage a tremendous show of force. As in the Whiskey Rebellion, the army he sent into eastern Pennsylvania seemed disproportionately large and heavy-handed compared to the threat, which had already begun to wane. The troops took 60 prisoners back to Philadelphia, where the chief instigators were tried and convicted of treason. In the spring of 1800, against the unanimous advice of his cabinet, President Adams reversed position and pardoned Freeze and 2 other convicted protesters, calling them obscure, miserable Germans, as ignorant of our language as they were of our laws. Adams thought treason too strong a charge to apply to the Pennsylvania rioters. The action was reminiscent of Washington's clemency after the Whiskey Rebellion, though it may have been influenced by Adams's fears that the German population would defect to the Republicans in the 1800 presidential election. Hamilton was dismayed by the pardon. Adams worried increasingly about the militaristic tendencies and authoritarian side that had emerged in the frustrated, restless Hamilton's behavior. He justly observed, "Mr. Hamilton's imagination was always haunted by that hideous monster or phantom so often called a crisis, and which so often produces imprudent measures." In later years, he congratulated himself that he had restrained Hamilton, who, save for me, would have involved us in a foreign war with France and a civil war with ourselves. What Adams could not admit was that he had failed to exercise strong leadership and had allowed the feud with Hamilton and his cabinet to fester. Escaping to his home in Quincy was not the most effective way to deal with political clashes. Chapter 33. Works Godly and Ungodly. On June 3, 1799, James Hamilton died on the small volcanic island of St. Vincent, having left the even tinier nearby island of Beckway 9 years earlier. He would have been about 80 years old. The fortunes of the elder Hamilton had never improved, and he ended up trapped on a bloody island that had witnessed terrible atrocities during the previous 4 years. Starting in 1795, native Caribs conspired with French inhabitants to spark an uprising on the British island. Many settlers were massacred and sugar plantations burned before British troops brutally put down the insurrection. This must have provided a frightening backdrop for the last years of the feeble, aging Hamilton. Alexander's failure to see James Hamilton during the last 34 years of his life raises anew the question of whether he was really Alexander's biological father, or whether Alexander simply felt alienated from a deeply flawed parent who had deserted the family and left him orphaned after his mother's death. Perhaps Hamilton was too busy for a trip back to the islands. Whatever the truth of this fathomless story, Hamilton had dutifully provided his father with financial aid, approximately 2 remittances per year, right up until his last payment at Christmas 1798. Like many self-invented immigrants, Hamilton had totally and irrevocably repudiated his past. He never evinced the slightest desire to revisit the haunts of his early life, and his upbringing remained a taboo topic. Yet childhood scenes may have continued to color the way he saw things, especially slavery. By the time he left the Treasury in 1795, slavery had begun to recede in New England and the Mid-Atlantic states. Rhode Island, Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut had decided to abolish it. Conspicuously missing were New York and New Jersey. So in January 1798, Hamilton resumed his association with the New York Manumission Society, his personal affiliation having lapsed during his Philadelphia years. Elected one of its 4 legal advisors, he helped defend free blacks when slave masters from out of state brandished bills of sale and tried to snatch them off the New York streets. In 1799, the society enjoyed a magnificent victory when the largely Federalist Assembly, voting along party lines, decreed the gradual abolition of slavery in New York State by a vote of 68 to 23. Aaron Burr, though he retained his own slave entourage for many years, defected to the Federalist majority. By 1804, New Jersey had followed New York's example, assuring that the North would extirpate the practice over the next generation, helping to set the stage for the Civil War. In the southern states, with their fast-growing slave population and the invention of the cotton gin, slavery became more ineradicable. Those founders bewitched by the fantasy that slavery would slowly fade away were being proved wrong. 20 years after New York decided to end slavery, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe still clung to such rationalizations, saying, for instance, that if slavery were extended into the new western states, it would weaken and die. Hamilton's name cropped up unexpectedly in the Manumission Society minutes for its March 1799 meeting. The society was trying to win the freedom of a slave named Sarah, who had been brought to New York from Maryland. It turned out, to Hamilton's embarrassment, that she belonged to his brother-in-law, John Barker Church. The minutes flagged this awkward circumstance without editorial comment. A. Hamilton was agent for Church in the business. John and Angelica Church had pressed Hamilton to purchase slaves for them before their return to New York. At the next meeting, it was reported that the Churches had suddenly given Sarah her freedom. This incident strengthens the hunch that one or both of the apparent references to slave purchases in Hamilton's cash books for 1796 and 1797 referred to purchases for the Churches, not for himself. By late 1795, we recall, Hamilton was already hunting for housing for his returning relatives. The Manumission Society's work was far from over. It ran a school for 100 black children, teaching them spelling, reading, writing, and arithmetic. It also protested an increasingly common practice. New York slaveholders were circumventing state laws by exporting slaves to the South, from where they were transferred to the West Indian sugar plantations that Hamilton had known as a boy. Hamilton refused to drop his involvement in the Manumission Society, even as his renown grew and his commitments vastly multiplied. He kept up his involvement as a legal advisor until his death. Was this perhaps his personal way of acknowledging the past by rectifying the injustice that had surrounded his early years? Hamilton's anti-slavery work in the late 1790s was paralleled by Eliza's growing activism on behalf of marginal and downtrodden people, work that was to dominate the last half-century of her life. Because Eliza Hamilton was a modest, self-effacing woman who apparently destroyed her own letters and tried to expunge her presence from the history books, the force of her personality and the magnitude of her contribution have been overlooked. Her son Alexander Jr. once described her as remarkable for sprightliness and vivacity. Her pioneering work to relieve the suffering of the poor has been all but forgotten. "She was a most earnest, energetic, and intelligent woman," said her son James. Her engagements as a principal of the Widows' Society and Orphan Asylum were incessant. The story of Eliza Hamilton's charitable work is inseparable from that of a remarkable Scottish widow named Isabella Graham, who came to New York in 1789 after her husband died of yellow fever in Antigua. A devout Presbyterian with three daughters, Graham decided to dedicate her life to godly work and befriended two clergymen in the Wall Street area who had stood among Hamilton's first American contacts, John Rogers and John Mason. Aided by these church leaders, Graham set up a school to inculcate Christian virtues and a sound education in fashionable young women. She was assisted by her daughter Joanna, who then married a well-to-do merchant, Richard Bethune. This marriage freed Graham from the need to run her school and enabled her to consecrate her efforts to the poor. In December 1797, mother and daughter launched a groundbreaking venture, the Society for the Relief of Poor Widows with Small Children. This missionary society, composed of Christian women from various denominations, may rank as the first all-female social service agency in New York City. Bearing food parcels and medicine to indigent widows, the Widows Society volunteers saved almost 100 women from the poorhouse during its first winter of operation alone. Eliza appeared on the membership rolls as Mrs. General Hamilton, and the Widows Society served as her entryway into a broader universe of evangelical social work. Joanna Bethune's son remembered Eliza thus. Her person was small and delicately formed, her face agreeable and animated by her brilliant black eyes, showing and radiating the spirit and intelligence so fully exhibited in her subsequent life. In the late 1790s, the unceasing demands of a growing family prevented Eliza from a full-scale commitment to Christian charity work. On November 26, 1799, she gave birth to her seventh child, Eliza, but she continued to shelter strays and waifs, a practice that she and Alexander had started in adopting Fanny Antill. In 1795, Eliza's brother, John Bradstreet Schuyler, had died, leaving a son, Philip Schuyler II. During the week, the boy attended school on Staten Island with the Hamilton boys, and then spent weekends with Uncle Alexander and Aunt Eliza. So Eliza's home was always bursting with youngsters demanding attention. Eliza was never allowed to forget the Reynolds affair, since the Republican press refreshed the public's memory at every opportunity. In December 1799, the Aurora pointed out gleefully that General Hamilton had arrived in Philadelphia after some recent sightings of his former mistress, implying that the affair continued. Mrs. Reynolds, alias Mariah, the sentimental heroine of the memorable Vindication, is said to be in Philadelphia once more. In the early part of last year, she was in town and had the imprudence to intrude herself on women of virtue with a relation of her story that she was the Mariah. In fact, Hamilton had never again set eyes on his quondam mistress. The ever-shifting Mariah Reynolds had recreated herself as a widow named Mariah Clement. In an attempt to gain respectability in Philadelphia, she ran the household of a French doctor. Nevertheless, the Republican papers continued to ride their favorite hobby horse, intimating that her romance with Hamilton still flourished. Hamilton found increasing pleasure at home at 26 Broadway. One senses that he and Eliza clung to each other with a deep sense of mutual need. I am well aware how much in my absence your affectionate and anxious heart needs the consolation of frequently hearing from me, and there is no consolation which I am not very much disposed to administer to it, he told Eliza in one letter. It deserves everything from me. I am much more in debt to you than I can ever pay, but my future life will be more than ever devoted to your happiness. The more despairing he became about politics and human nature, and his worldview was never very rosy to begin with, the more he appreciated his sincere, unpretentious wife. From Philadelphia, he wrote to her, "You are my good genius of that kind which the ancient philosophers called a familiar, and you know very well that I am glad to be in every way as familiar as possible with you." He concluded, "Adieu, best of wives and best of mothers." Even a rugged soldier's life, once his sovereign remedy for all ills, no longer possessed its curative powers. I discover more and more that I am spoiled for a military man, he told Eliza. My health and comfort require that I should be at home, at that home where I am always sure to find a sweet asylum from care and pain in your bosom. Hamilton never stopped doting on Angelica Church. During one stay with his in-laws in Albany, he found himself seated at dinner opposite a John Trumbull portrait of her and her son Philip. Hamilton sent Angelica a witty letter describing how he had dined in the mute presence of a special lady friend. I was placed directly in front of her and was much occupied with her during the whole dinner. She did not appear to her usual advantage, and yet she was very interesting. The eloquence of silence is not a common attribute of hers, but on this occasion she employed it perforce, and it was not considered as a fault. Though I am fond of hearing her speak, her silence was so well placed that I did not attempt to make her break it. You will conjecture that I must have been myself dumb with admiration. Hamilton was approaching his mid-40s and perhaps feeling his age. His high-pressure life was still packed with plenty of responsibilities. As Inspector General, he bore single-handedly the weight of an entire army while trying to retain his restive legal clients. The law has nearly abandoned him, or rather, he has forsaken it, Robert Troop told Rufus King. The loss he sustains is immense. Hamilton's life began to lose some of its clockwork precision, and the darkness of depression again invaded his mind. While staying with Oliver Wolcott Jr. in November 1798, Hamilton watched the emaciated Mrs. Wolcott wasting away from a terminal disease. He confessed to Eliza that he was haunted by despondent thoughts that he could not shake. I am quite well, but I know not what impertinent gloom hangs over my mind, which I fear will not be entirely dissipated until I rejoin my family. A letter from you telling me that you and my dear children are well will be a consolation. During one trip, he told Angelica Church of a sadness which took possession of his heart after leaving New York. These confessional remarks leap off the page because Hamilton seldom admitted to anxiety in this candid manner and tended to shield his innermost thoughts. Now an invalid crippled by gout and abdominal troubles, Philip Schuyler worried about the punishing demands that his son-in-law made on himself. In early 1799, he again exhorted Hamilton to relax. Mrs. Church writes me that you suffer from want of exercise, that this and unremitted attention to business injures your health. I believe it is difficult for an active mind to moderate an application to business, but, my dear sir, you must make some sacrifice to that health which is so precious to all who are dear to you, and to that country which reveres and esteems you. Let me then entreat you to use more bodily exercise and less of that of the mind. Schuyler discreetly exhorted Eliza to saddle Hamilton's horse every day and get him to ride in the fresh air. Hamilton did engage in some outdoor recreation. He had recently bought a rifle and liked to go out hunting with a retriever dog named Old Peggy. With his fowling piece in hand, a light gun with A. Hamilton, N.Y. carved into its stock, he sometimes roamed the Harlem forests, searching for birds to shoot. At other times, he prowled the Hudson, fishing for striped bass. He was still an habitué of the theater, whether classical tragedies or lighter fare, and he attended the Philharmonic Society concerts at Snow's Hotel on Broadway. Hamilton's problem was never a shortage of interests so much as the time to cultivate them. On occasion, Hamilton gave evidence of a prankish spirit at odds with the image of the sober public man. While on a visit to Newark, Hamilton's aide, Philip Church, met a Polish poet, Julian Niemczewicz, a friend of General Tadeusz Kosciuszko. Niemczewicz insisted that Kosciuszko had entrusted him with a magic secret that permitted him to summon up spirits from the grave. Hamilton, intrigued, invited the Polish poet to a Friday evening soiree. To give conclusive proof of his black art, Niemczewicz asked Hamilton to step into an adjoining room so that he could not see what was going on. Then one guest wrote down on a card the name of a dead warrior, the Baron de Viamonil, who had seen action at Yorktown, and asked the Polish poet to conjure up his shade. Niemczewicz uttered a string of incantations accompanied by a constantly clanging bell. When it was over, Hamilton strode into the room and declared that the Baron de Viamonil had appeared to him exactly in the dress which he formerly wore and that a conversation had passed between them which he was not at liberty to disclose, related Peter Jay, the governor's son. That Hamilton had communed with a fallen comrade attracted exceptional attention in New York society, so much so that he had to admit that it was all a hoax he had cooked up with Philip Church and Niemczewicz to frighten the family for amusement, and that it was never intended to be made public. The yellow fever epidemic of 1798 that had claimed the lives of Benjamin Franklin Bache and John Fenno had also given fresh urgency to the work of the Widows' Society, as many women lost their family breadwinners. None but eyewitnesses, Isabella Graham wrote, could have imagined the sufferings of so many respectable, industrious women who never thought to ask bread of any but of God. This same scourge led the more profane Aaron Burr to create quite a different sort of institution in New York, the Manhattan Company. To understand this pivotal moment between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, one must fathom the severity of the epidemic that had struck the city that autumn. In September, as many as 45 victims perished per day, and Hamilton and his family even briefly took rooms several miles from town. Robert Troup described the terrifying paralysis that gripped New York. "Our courts are shut up, our trade totally stagnant, and we have little or no appearance of business. I call in once a day at Hamilton's, and we endeavor to fortify each other with philosophy to bear the ills we cannot cure." Wealthier residents escaped to rural outskirts, while the poor were exposed to a disease spread by mosquitoes that multiplied around the many swamps and stagnant ponds. Almost 2,000 New Yorkers died, and a fresh potter's field was consecrated in what is now Greenwich Village. Aaron Burr's brother-in-law, Dr. Joseph Brown, blamed contaminated water for the recurrent outbreaks of yellow fever. The city still depended on often polluted wells, and submitted a plan to the Common Council for drawing fresh water from the Bronx River. Brown's plan contemplated the creation of a private water corporation chartered by the state legislature. The pipe water was also hailed as a panacea for other civic needs, ranging from fighting fires to washing filthy streets. Although the Common Council applauded the basic concept of a water company, it countered with a proposal for a public company to conduct this business. In reality, Brown's plan was a ruse concocted by Burr, who had no interest whatever in pure water, but considerable interest in setting up a Republican bank. Among the many putative advantages Hamilton and his Federalist associates enjoyed in New York politics was a virtual monopoly over local banking. At the start of 1799, both of the banks in New York City happened to be the brainchildren of Alexander Hamilton, the Bank of New York and the local branch of the Bank of the United States. Republican businessmen nursed a perennial grievance that these banks discriminated against them. One Republican journalist charging that it became at length impossible for men engaged in trade to advocate Republican sentiments without sustaining material injury. As the rage and violence of party increased, directors became more rigorous in enforcing their system of exclusion. It is not clear that Republicans were actually penalized, but the suspicion was certainly abroad. Hamilton opposed the vogue for state banks that proliferated in the 1790s, less from narrow political motives than from a fear that competition among banks would dilute credit standards and invite imprudent lending practices as bankers vied for clients. Now a member of the New York Assembly, Burr knew that any politician who smashed the Federalist monopoly in local banking would attain heroic status among Republicans, at least those who did not regard banks as diabolical instruments. Easy access to a bank also appealed to an incorrigible spendthrift such as Burr, who had ongoing money problems. In early 1797, toward the end of his term in the U.S. Senate, his financial troubles had grown so acute that he had neglected his legislative duties. To establish a New York bank, he had to scale a very high hurdle. The state legislature conferred bank charters, and it was currently under Federalist sway. In those days, every New York corporation engaged in business needed a legislative charter. As the crafty Burr cast about for a stratagem that would let him sneak a bank charter past the opposition party, he hit upon the unlikely subterfuge of using the proposed water company as a blind. In a cunning political sleight of hand, Burr lined up a bipartisan coalition of six luminaries, three Republicans and three Federalists, to approach the Common Council as sponsors of his proposal for a private water company. For his Federalist phalanx, he recruited Julian Verplank, president of the Bank of New York, John Murray, president of the Chamber of Commerce, and his greatest prize, Major General Alexander Hamilton. Why did Hamilton go along with Burr? Burr had recently flirted with the Federalists and had cooperated with Hamilton to fortify New York City against a French invasion. For the moment, the two men stood on a relatively good footing. Hamilton had survived yellow fever and would have favored a project to save the city from further epidemics. Hamilton may also have been investigating a business opportunity for John B. Church. Angelica had prodded her husband to give up his parliamentary career and return to America, but now Church seemed bored, if fabulously prosperous, in New York. Hamilton noted, "He has little to do, and time hangs heavy on his hands." Church emerged as a director of the Manhattan Company, which may have been a precondition for Hamilton's participation. Whatever Hamilton's motives, one Burr biographer has written, no member of the Committee of Six worked harder than Hamilton to make possible Aaron Burr's upcoming triumph in the New York legislature. On February 22, 1799, Hamilton and Burr marched into the office of Mayor Richard Varick to plead the Water Company's case. After conferring with an English canal engineer, Hamilton drew up an impressive memo that went far beyond waterworks to a systematic plan for draining city swamps and installing sewers. Persuaded by Hamilton, the Common Council ceded the final decision to the state legislature. Burr must have savored the situation. He was exploiting Alexander Hamilton and enlisting his foe's mighty pen in a clandestine Republican cause. It was exactly the sort of joke that the drolly mysterious Burr treasured. He also got Hamilton to prepare a memo for the state legislature in support of a private water company. In late March, obliging state legislators approved the creation of the Manhattan Company, and on April 2nd, an unsuspecting Governor John Jay signed this act into law.
Earlier promises about the company providing free water to combat fires and repair city streets damaged by laying pipes, standard features of water company contracts in other states, had been quietly deleted by Burr from the final bill.
As usual, the devil lay in the details. At the final moment, with many legislators having departed for home and others too lazy to examine the fine print, Burr embedded a brief provision in the bill that widened immeasurably the scope of future company activities. This momentous language said that it shall and may be lawful for the said company to employ all such surplus capital as may belong or accrue to the said company in the purchase of public or other stock or in any other moneyed transactions of operations. The surplus capital loophole would allow Burr to use the Manhattan Company as a bank or any other kind of financial institution. The Federalists had dozed right through this deception because they knew of the Republican antipathy for banks and also because Burr had cleverly decorated the board with eminent Federalists. Burr, it turned out, was too smart for his own good. If some Republicans admired his finesse, the general electorate did not. At the end of April, as he faced a re-election campaign for his assembly seat, voters grasped the magnitude of his deception and shunned the ticket he headed. Once Hamilton realized that Burr had hoodwinked him, he was livid. He later complained of Burr, "I have been present when he has contended against banking systems with earnestness and with the same arguments that Jefferson would use. Yet he has lately by a trick established a bank, a perfect monster in its principles, but a very convenient instrument of profit and influence." Even some stalwart Republicans shuddered at Burr's machinations. Of Burr's discredited slate, Peter R. Livingston commented that it would hardly be a wonder if they did lose the election, for they had such a damned ticket that no decent man could hold up his head to support it. Burr's editor, Mary Jo Klein, has observed that the Manhattan Company scheme was so baldly self-serving that it temporarily halted Burr's political career and lost him the public office that had served him so well. On April 22nd, when Manhattan Company shares went on sale, they were instantly snapped up. In early September, dropping any pretense that it was principally a water company, the company opened with great fanfare its new Office of Discount and Deposit on Wall Street. This bank immediately posed a competitive threat to the Bank of New York, now housed in an elegant two-story building down the block at Wall and William Streets. By its wondrously vague charter, a magic carpet of corporate possibilities, the Manhattan Company was allowed to raise $2 million, operate anywhere, and go on in perpetuity, whereas the Bank of New York had less than $1 million in capital, was restricted to operations in the city, and had a charter that expired in 1811. To purchase the favor of all political cliques, Burr shrewdly parceled out the company's 12 directorships, dispensing 9 to Republicans, with places carefully allocated for Clintonians, Livingstons, and Burrites, and 3 to Federalists, including John Barker Church. Perhaps the least of Aaron Burr's sins in organizing the Manhattan Company was his having gulled Hamilton and state legislators into granting a bank charter under false pretenses. Far more grievous were the fraudulent claims he had made for a water company.